You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. And I have one of my favorite people joining me this evening, Miss Stephanie Crawford. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I don't know why I'm singing.
Are we doing jazz hands?
I like yes. This. I always podcast with jazz hands. That's something that people don't actually know. And it's totally lost on radio, but it's a method thing, and I have to anyway. So Miss Crawford, you and I are talking about a couple of TV movies this evening, and they are well known and well renowned television movies from the 1970s. One of them is called Bad Ronald, which has just come out from Warner Archive, and the other one is called Trilogy of Terror, which has come out from Kino Lorber. How do you feel about TV movies in general? Just a broad question before we get into this, because I feel like watching these made me kind of miss them, despite, you know, some issues that could arise from watching these movies now. I still kind of miss the format itself.
Okay, well, it's just a different landscape, isn't it?
It
used to be an event back in the day when there were fewer channels. You could actually get the family together. It would be something you could look up in TV Guide and talk about all week and all watch together. So there's that nostalgic link to it, absolutely. When I grew up, I think most of the TV movies I watched were, what was that one? I think it was Saturday night, or it might have been Sunday, but it was on the Disney Channel.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. It was like, not Disney Presents, but it was something like that, the Disney movie. Yeah, those were really cool. I used to make an effort when I could to see that stuff. And some of that stuff I feel like has never been made available. You know, like there was one called, not scary at all, but it's called Ask Max.
On the next Disney Sunday movie.
His inventions are pretty neat, but they always backfire.
What you are trying to do has never been done before.
We need this fight.
He wants to be a vice president.
So is this like a club or what?
A junior high genius uses his brain, bike, and bucks.
Especially big bucks.
To win friends and influence everybody.
So what's wrong with that?
It's the Goonies' Jeff Cohn and special guest star Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the high-flying comedy Ask Max.
With Jeff Cohn from the Goonies. Do you remember that one?
No.
Do you ever see that? He like plays this like wunderkind kind of genius kid who gets teased a lot, but then he invents this crazy bicycle that will, like, it's basically got two pogo sticks on the back wheel. And when he presses a button, once he figures this out, the bike like jumps high in the air. And then there's this whole thing where he's given this like advanced check from this company that's buying his bike idea, but he can't use the bike in public at all, or he blows the whole deal, and one of his friends is in trouble and he has to use the bike. And anyway, I found a really crappy bootleg of it, but it's not really available. It's not a full length movie. Some of those weren't. I think that's interesting too, that these movies are often pretty short. So you have a lot of economic storytelling, which is definitely something I thought about Bad Ronald for sure. So that is different too. Yeah, it's just a whole different thing. So these Disney things, you remember those fondly?
I do. They would show reruns of Walt hosting them, and then they would have new ones with Michael Eisner hosting them.
Good evening and welcome to Classic Night on the Disney Sunday Movie. For weeks now, Mickey has been upset with us because we haven't shown any of his cartoons on the Sunday Movie. Every day he reminds me that not only was he Walt Disney's first star, but he's also the only mouse to ever win an Academy Award. Well, Mickey, I guarantee you we haven't forgotten.
And I think back on now and I'm like, why did I know who Michael Eisner, the CEO, was when I was a child? He just insisted on hosting them. But the time period I grew up, TV movies were mostly things like Wish Upon a Star on the Disney Channel. So unfortunately, I missed the golden age.
Yeah, the 70s seems to have been a really big time. And I don't remember seeing a lot of this stuff on TV. Like, I didn't see Bad Ronald on TV. And we were just not hip enough to know when, you know, TV movies were on and stuff. And I'm kind of glad I did. I'm pretty sure these movies would have messed me up, as it sounds like they messed a lot of people up, if I had seen them when they aired. But yeah, it's definitely between like early 70s through, I want to say, early to mid 80s. Although I know that there's an interview Amanda Reyes did with the Warner Archive people talking about Bad Ronald on their podcast recently. And she said something like, 5,000 TV movies were made between 1960, I want to say, 3 or 4, and 1999. And that's
Holy
crazy.
God.
That's just insane, right? So a whole lot of content, a whole lot of films that a whole lot of people haven't seen, you know,
and
which I think
these
is
days it seems mainly the domain of Hallmark and Lifetime.
Yep. Yeah. And those, I don't feel the same
No, it's definitely different, especially if you pretty much dedicate your entire channel to that.
Yeah, it's just, although I did watch that one that Mr. Patrick Bromley recommended. What was that Christmas thing, like the 13 days of Christmas or something like that?
How'd they make
the one
so
with Amy
many
Smart.
Of them?
He recommended one on F This Movie that was like Groundhog Day but at Christmas with Amy Smart. That was pretty good because I love time bounce movies. Anyway, I'm getting way off topic with the TV movie stuff, but it is a fascinating, like you say, landscape, and it's different than what we have now. And it's too bad because, you know, a lot of these productions were made pretty quickly, but pretty well, all things considered. And they put some big budget Hollywood films of today to shame in terms of what they pull off with what they have, in my opinion.
Right, and the last time I was on, we talked about John Carpenter's Someone's Watching Me, which is an incredibly impressive television movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the best. I mean, that to me is for sure one of my favorites, and I think our discussion of it and watching it again on that Blu-ray for the show made me realize just how much I like that movie. And how much you can do with, again, with the format. So
bring them back.
So
TV executives listening
okay.
to the show.
Well, I've heard, and they made some mention on the Warner Archive thing with Amanda Reyes, that they got some in the works for Blu-ray, that they've released something like 300 on DVD, which I realized they had released a lot. I guess I just didn't realize how many. But they said that they have more TV movies for Blu-ray in the works, which
that
is exciting because I have no idea what they'll be.
Maybe they can start doing themed box sets.
Oh, TV movie box sets?
Yeah.
Oh, I like that idea. You know what they haven't? That's one thing Warner Archive hasn't done enough of. And I love what they do. But box sets, they could really be doing that kind of thing. I mean, there must be some numbers that they're looking at somewhere that say that box sets don't do as well for them as individual releases.
I could see that.
Because I can't imagine why they wouldn't.
Outside of TV shows, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But they put out so many thematically similar movies that I feel like could go together really well. Like, what did they just put out? Like, for instance, Queen of Outer Space and The Cyclops. And I feel like there was another recent, like, you know, sci-fi movie from that period that could have all gone together in a box set. So that's too bad. It's clearly not something they're into right now, but
well, Warner,
I'm excited to see.
Sorry. Warner Archive, I'm not sure it was them, but just Warner used to do those great DVD box sets. Like, one of my favorites was Controversial Classics.
Ooh, remind me what that was.
I think that was the one, and it had like
So are these those like 4-pack movies?
Well, Bad Day at Black Rock was on there.
Oh,
what's my favorite one on there? About like Lonesome Jim Rhodes.
Oh, Facing the Crowd.
Yes.
Right? So it was like, okay, so it was Advise and Consent, Bad Day at Black Rock, Blackboard Jungle, I'm a Fugitive, I Was a Fugitive from a Chain
Emily.
Gang.
Yeah, so they're very different films, but it was a really cool little theme. I would love something like that. And TV movies, I think, that's enough of a giant umbrella. And then you could be like, oh, scary ones that made it hard to fall asleep after ones are romantic intrigue, the box set. They can have this for free. I mean, they should give me the box set, but
I think they should.
They can have the idea.
No, I never saw this controversial classic set. This is pretty cool, actually. Those are all great movies, and only Bad Day at Black Rock and Americanization of Emily are on Blu-ray from this set.
Yeah, I've hung on to all of them.
No, I mean, Face in the Crowd really needs a Blu-ray.
I cannot believe A Face in the Crowd isn't on Blu-ray.
I feel
it's a masterpiece.
Absolutely. No, I was...
There's no hyperbole there.
Not at all.
And unfortunately, it is incredibly timely right now. This is the perfect time to release it.
Oh my gosh, so much. I was just watching an old favorite last week called King of Comedy, and those two films together.
You like that movie?
Nah, maybe. I know I don't really show it. It's not something
no one could have ever guessed.
Commonly known. But yeah, Facing the Crowd is like the King of Comedy before King of Comedy, and it is something else, I'll tell you. Wow, that box set's worth a lot of money, by the way.
That's, I know, that was $50. Surprising. More the reason for to get on Blu-ray.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk about this this Bad Ronald thingy here.
Say you're sorry.
After an accidental murder, Ronald, a lonely and unpopular boy, takes refuge in a fantasy world.
All will be for nothing if we don't heed the rules.
Today I begin joining Princess Fansetta. She's the ruler of Atranta.
An existence that becomes inescapable and deadly. Starring Kim Hunter, Dabney Coleman, and Scott Jacoby in a compelling thriller, Bad Ronald.
This one is one of the most, in at least as far as my experience, one of the most famous TV movies maybe ever. I think due in part to its genre trappings and the fact that it's just such a weird story in a way. I think it looks like it originally aired on October 23rd, 1974. And you had not seen this one, correct?
Correct. And it's so funny because I think throughout the years I had heard the title in passing, but I don't think I heard in context of it being a TV movie. So I assumed it was just a horror movie. I think the first time I heard exactly what it was and that it was a TV movie was just last year. And I think it was Mike from the Splat House podcast is actually a big fan, and he was just telling me about it. So it's funny to me that's so infamous, and I tweeted about it, and so many people are like, oh my God, that movie. No one appreciates this movie as much as they should. I was like, oh man, I really missed the boat for a long time.
Well, I think it's one of those that people really took possession of, as they do with a lot of TV movies, because they truly get lost. And though this movie has had a couple DVD releases, it's only had those since, I want to say, 2009. Prior to that, I mean, I guess you could watch it on YouTube, but one of the big things about these movies is that they just are not remembered because they're unavailable for whatever reason. That, you know, the rights holders, at least to a point, weren't really concerned with putting them out. So everybody was forced to sort of hang on to their memories of these crazy movies that they saw as a kid and that clearly left some kind of indelible impression, but they couldn't rewatch them. And I think so, you know, they would seek out bootlegs. And I think when that kind of search is involved with something, it really, you know, lights that passion for a movie and it really makes you feel like you have to champion it because it literally is not easy to see. And if you don't talk about it, it basically goes away. So
absolutely. There's a treasure hunt aspect to it, I think. And
for sure.
Introducing someone to that, especially if you're like, oh, okay, this is like a fifth generation copy of it, but you have to see it, and then they get into it. It's always really satisfying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, and it's fun when the movies kind of live up to the hype, as it were, you know, and I feel like this one does in a lot of ways. But for people that don't know, the basic premise is that Scott Jacoby plays this guy, Ronald, and he is kind of a nerdy kid. He has a really rough opening couple minutes of this movie where, you know, he lives with his mom, his dad is out of the picture, and he goes over to this girl's house to ask her out on a date, and he is horribly ridiculed.
Laurie, there's someone here to see you.
It's only water.
Some people even walk with it, Ronald.
Hi.
Ronald, what do you want?
Well, I was just wandering around and I thought I'd come by and see what you were doing.
Swimming. Come on in, Ronald. If you can swim, I mean.
Or if you can't. Would you like to go to the movies? There's a good double feature play.
I can. I'm doing something else.
What a joke.
See you later, Ronald.
Yeah, bye, Ronald. Come back, we can't stay so long.
Stay dry.
Don't forget to set the gate.
From the outside, Ronald.
And on the way home, there's an accident where a little girl is killed, and he sort of has to take refuge, and his mom gets the idea of hiding him in a spare bathroom that they have in the house, where they sort of wall it over with drywall and wallpaper, and then he finds a way to sort of get into the walls of the house.
Your meals won't be exciting, but you'll be able to feed yourself while I'm gone.
I'll be sure and study.
And exercise. I know it'll be easy for you to become careless without my attention, but you must not break the routine. Now close the door.
Mother, I'm afraid.
There's nothing to be afraid of as long as you listen to me. Now close the door. And don't open it until I return.
But, and I hate to spoil too much, but it's kind of the setup of the movie. His mom gets sick and ends up dying in the hospital, and then he's stuck in the walls of this house, and he can't leave because if he does, the police will get him. And so then another family moves in, and it becomes this weird scenario where he's in the walls, and they're in the house, and... yeah, it kind of goes from there.
It does have great possibilities.
Yeah, it does.
I think we could get a bedroom.
We need a new bathroom, too, but I want the bedroom right upstairs.
No, I get the one.
No.
Daddy has something to say.
I don't know. What do you think?
That's unusual.
I can manage it. I think it'd be terrific.
I'll stay.
If we can get rid of the dusty old
musty
mess.
We can, darling. We can.
It's interesting. I guess I just don't like sterile things. Don't you think it has a lot of character?
Has anybody seen our new neighbor?
She wasn't very friendly when I said hello.
Oh, your shyness probably startled her.
Oh, look who's talking.
Althea, Ellen, now come on, ladies.
It's awfully dreary, but it does have great possibilities.
But that's...
Yeah.
I was thinking we all get a room.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute, girls.
We need a bathroom.
Wait a minute. Hold it.
What is it, darling?
Now, look, I would like to make a decision today.
Yeah, so would I.
So, what do you say?
Well, I'm for it.
I love it.
Me too.
I think it's a crazy house.
What does that mean?
Like the houses you see in movies.
You watch too much television.
You watch too
much television.
She's always watching television.
Look, most of those old Victorian houses had strange reputations, but they weren't deserved.
Bad?
Maybe there's even a ghost or two.
That's enough. That's enough of that now. Cut that out. Now, look, are we for it or not?
I say yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Babs?
Okay.
Yeah!
All done.
You're as beautiful as a princess. You must be the one.
It's a strange setup, I gotta say. But what did you think of it?
Especially for a TV movie, like what a conceit. I would have loved
Crazy.
To have been at that pitch meeting.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like there must have been some kind of autonomy. I mean, it's based on a book, which apparently is kind of different from this story. Like the Ronald character is much more of a sociopath and apparently kind of a rapist and just really not a good character at all. So they've done a lot in the way of making him more sympathetic, and that's certainly due to the writing of the character, but also due to Scott Jacoby's performance. And I like Scott Jacoby quite a bit. I think he's a really good actor. So anyway, yeah, it's a strange setup for whatever. I can't even to have pitched the book would have, I can't believe that would have gone, or any version of the book. So yeah, I don't know quite how this one got by.
Yeah, they would have to cut out a lot, not only for standards, but this is only 74 minutes long.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning before about the economy of storytelling. That setup that I mentioned happens within the first like 10 minutes of the movie about, and so you really get going quickly, and you can often sacrifice something in the way of connection with characters when you're moving so fast like that. But for some reason, it kind of works. And again, I think it has a lot to do with Scott Jacoby and how he comes off. And then Kim Hunter, who plays his mom, is really great too, in this sort of odd, eccentric, you know, do anything for my kid kind of way. It's weird to see her not in ape makeup. That's what I always remember her from, is Planet of the Apes. But she's really good. She's really good in this. That would be a whole different movie.
Yeah, she's that classic overbearing mother who, in her mind, she's doing a great job. She's taking care of her baby, but she obviously is doing it in a very unhealthy way. Yeah, Ronald, he's a good kid. Basically, his one problem is his overbearing mom. He's really bright. He's looking forward to college. He studies hard, but she's almost, this is almost a big opportunity for her. I think if she didn't die, she would have just kept him inside the walls for as long as possible. Like, even if he was 40 That's years true. Old, she's like, but the police are still looking for you. Just drink some more milk. It's okay. It's a really gross but interesting dynamic.
I agree.
I was surprised when she died, because I really thought it would be about the escalation of their strange relationship. But
you didn't know, you just knew, what did you know about the movie going in? Did you know about him in the walls?
Yeah, I knew it was about a young kid in the walls, but that's it. Okay. That's literally it.
Interesting. Well, that's cool. I spoiled that for everybody else. But regardless, yeah, that's neat. So, wow, that must have been an interesting surprise. And that's one of the things I had forgotten about the movie, is kind of how sad it is.
Yeah.
It's pretty heartbreaking in a lot of ways.
Oh, of course.
Because you feel for him right away, and you sort of understand that he mostly understands the impact of his mistake and how horrible it is. And his mom is basically telling him, like, yes, it's horrible, but I can't lose you, and so we're going to have to do this other thing. And then when she dies, it's just like he's all alone, literally all alone in this. And that's, I don't know, that's a really tough thing for me to not, you know, feel sort of some empathy for, despite the fact that he's, you know, a murderer or manslaughter or whatever. I mean, it was an accidental death, but he's got this whole thing, not to go too far into it, where he's sort of created this fantastic storied universe that's kind of like a, it feels like an old style, you know, almost like a Dungeons and Dragons kind of campaign, with a, you know, evil king character and a princess character. And then he starts to transpose those characters onto real people, and that starts to go bad for him. So that stuff I found really interesting on top of an already interesting story, But overall, you were a fan. You I don't want to say enjoyed, but you got something out of it.
I did like that, because I felt like he created that fantasy life to keep his sanity.
Yeah.
And it ended up eating his sanity.
It's true.
And I loved, even with the short running time, they would take moments to, like, when the family would leave, he would run out into their kitchen and eat from the fridge and kind of eyeball their milk and drink enough, but leave just enough so they wouldn't become too suspicious. And like you said, you feel a lot for him when he's just watching them having a family dinner. Like in the, he's this dirty kid staring through the walls at them, just having a family dinner. And those are the moments where you really feel for him. And it's interesting because he, you know, even though innocent little girl gets killed, it was an accident, though he was beating her up. It,
he was getting violent.
It's interesting how, I'm sorry, again, in the running time, how it starts out with him as a victim, and then he turns into, well, other people turn into the victim, and it feels so natural. Yeah. And then when everything comes together at the end, you're not like, yeah, you're just like, oh man, everyone is so young, and where's everyone's parents? Yeah. What happened here?
Yeah, it really escalates in an interesting way that I had forgotten. I had seen it when it came out on DVD a couple, you know, 4 or 5 years ago or whatever. But I'd forgotten the ending. And yeah, when it gets to that place, you're just like, oh man, it's rough. It's a rough watch in some ways.
And his big eyes behind those glasses, it reminded me of Corey Haim and Lucas.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. Well, that and the fact that, like you said, he's dirty. So you get that sense of like the bathroom that he's staying in doesn't have a shower.
No.
It has a sink, but he's not taking care of himself and his mom's not there. And you're kind of like, oh man, this poor kid can't even wash himself properly.
There's another point where the family leaves and he develops a crush on one of the girls living there and he runs to try to look in her diary, and my first thought was like, no, take this chance to take a shower.
I thought at some point he might, but then there was a point where I was just like, yeah, no, I think that's off his radar now. I don't think that's a thing he's thinking about.
He's a wall kid now.
Yeah, wall kids don't shower.
I was a wall kid.
You were a wall kid.
I have a story if you'd like to hear that. Okay.
I would like to hear your wall kid story. Go for it.
So back when I lived in New Mexico, we had a swamp cooler put in and they cut this square into the wall inside of the downstairs coat closet and you could just remove it. And I looked in there. I was like, it kind of looks like there's a room in there. So I grabbed a flashlight and I just crawled through and it was a perfect room.
Whoa.
You know, like there's no light, obviously, and there are beams in weird places, but it was basically like a room and it was really cool in there. So I remember I brought in my Little Mermaid sleeping bag and my parents were like, okay, well, we're going to store Christmas stuff here too, but you can have the rest of it. So it became like my tiny little second bedroom,
like a fort.
Yeah. And then I remember on my 16th birthday as a Halloween party, I'm like, do y'all want to see my wall room? And they're like,
oh my,
yes. So we all crawled in and I had them all sign the walls. And I was wondering,
oh, that's cool,
if the people who moved in after us ever found the room, and then if they just looked in, they're like, what the hell happened in here?
Wow, that is awesome. You have a personal connection to this movie.
I did.
That must have made it that much better.
Mine was a lot happier, thankfully, but yeah, I
know
what it's like to live in the walls.
Sounds like it was a big space if you could fit like a whole birthday party.
Oh yeah, no, it was, I mean, if you bought a house and they called it a bedroom, you'd be incredibly pissed off. But
okay.
As an unexpected like little alcove, it's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, the only thing I can tie that this to is a story that Darren Lynn Bousman. So the story I'm remembering he told on Killer POV, and I can't find it anymore because those episodes aren't around. But it was that I think, and I'm paraphrasing the story, so it's not going to come out quite right, but it was super creepy because it really happened to him. But it was basically like in his parents' house when he was a kid, they were having some work done on their attic, and apparently there was like a sort of a side room area that had been sort of developed by the construction. And I don't know if it had been walled off completely or not, but there was one morning when he was up there for some reason and there was a dude living in their attic. I'm getting tingles telling this story. No. It's not even my story. But
Halloween
he
was
up there and
man.
And he just like looked at Darren and was like shh, you know, gave him like a shush or something. And Darren flipped out and ran down and told his parents, and I guess the guy went away, but they found like all these magazines, and the dude had been like in their attic for like, I don't know, a month or more, a while.
I have chills, and like actual chills.
It's, the story just creeps the shit out of me to think about. And I still think about my own attic and like, you know, you hear something going on and you're like, what's going on up there? And just the idea of, you know, that just reminded me when I was tweeting about Bad Ronald, somebody was tweeting about Gary Busey and Hyder in the house, which is another very interesting.
Gary Busey's hiding in the house. I'm not sleeping tonight.
Have you seen Hyder in the house?
I'm not sleeping tonight.
I'm sorry. I'm creeping you out. But Hyder in the house is pretty hilarious. But just the idea of somebody living in your house and sneaking out when you're not around is like one of those things that really gets to me. Just like The Strangers really gets to me. Home Invasion gets to me.
No.
It's this whole...
It's the one place you can be yourself, that you can relax and not wear pants if you don't have to. And someone invading that. No, I'm with you.
Right? Not cool. Just not cool. Another thing that I loved about this movie is there's a... Well, it's kind of annoying, but there's a sort of old lady neighbor character that's always spying on the house, and I think she suspects that he's in there, and so we kind of always see her like creeping around, looking in the windows. Even after the mom is dead, she's still like, you know, I guess has her busybody theories. But so there's always this tension whenever he comes out of the room that either A, the family haven't left the house yet, or somebody's going to come back in, or the old woman's going to see him. And so even though I had seen this movie, I was still just like, oh my God, please go back in the room, please. And that kind of built-in tension is incredibly engaging to me. So I really enjoy that kind of... I mean, enjoy is not quite the right word, but it's just like, oh, it really gets me, you know?
I'm completely with you. I was like, let him eat the hard-boiled eggs. Just mind your garden, woman. Stay away from the windows, Ronald.
Yeah, it's great. And I should, before I forget, the family is really interesting because the dad is played by Dabney Coleman.
Not playing an evil guy.
What's it? Yeah, no, for once he's relatively sympathetic, sort of. And then the daughters are played by Lisa Albacher, who I always know from Beverly Hills Cop. She's Eddie Murphy's friend that lives in Beverly Hills, this woman. And she's in 10 to Midnight, too, I think, with... I think she's Charles Bronson's daughter in that. But anyway, the family dynamic is very interesting because the daughters, there's, you know, a range of three of them and their different ages, and how they interact is interesting. And the one that Ronald sort of becomes obsessed with, like her dynamic versus the other two is interesting. There's just a lot going on in this very compact little tale. So I don't know. I'm glad it came off well, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's even like Ronald's quote unquote bully, who was a jerk to him.
Oh yeah.
They even give him a backstory. They make him sympathetic.
Yeah, we don't have to tell what.
Right. But
because that isn't made clear in the beginning, and I had forgotten that for sure. Like the sort of his sort of reveal, and I was like, wow, that's interesting. Okay. You're trying to make me conflicted about this guy, although he is a dick.
Yeah, they juggle a lot of complex relationships in this little film. It's really impressive. Yeah, I can see why this would really wedge itself into people's brains, especially if they saw it at an impressionable age, but it's really well done. It's genuinely creepy.
Yeah.
But I think even during the more quiet scenes, the family scenes, it's still enjoyable to watch because it's so well done. You're not just like, okay, when is something crazy going to happen?
Well, there's just not too many movies like it. I mean, like I said, I was making the Hyder in the house joke because there's one of a guy living in the walls. But there aren't too many
Sarah Kinski in
that
your
I can
cellar.
Think of movies where people live in the walls of a house. It just doesn't happen that
no.
much.
No. It's definitely a sub-genre.
Sub-sub, yeah, for sure. So I think that's neat, and I think that the idea of a unique premised movie that then was unavailable for a long time really sets this thing up to be remembered, and it's neat how its life has carried on to the point where, you know, Warner Archive realizes we got to put this thing out, and it looks incredible on Blu-ray. Like, it's just nuts to think of this. I mean, granted, it is 4x3 because it's a TV movie, but it's really surprising how good this Blu-ray looks. I was not totally shocked because the Warner Archive does great work. The only thing I would have loved to have had would have been some extras. Unfortunately, yeah, it doesn't
have
any.
Why are we talking about a bare bones disc?
Sorry. It's a rare occasion we're going to talk about a bare bones. Just because I'm excited that the movie's available and I think more people should see it. So anyway, moving on to another movie. I'm sorry. Do you have anything else you want to add about Bad Ronald?
Well, no. I'll just say, the runtime does not leave anything for fat. It's all killer and no filler.
100%. That phrase is invented for movies like this.
Exactly. So I guess next time they're doing like a 4 for $40 sale, I would definitely recommend it.
For sure. So the next movie we're going to talk about is equally coveted and well remembered by a lot of people, and I think even more traumatic in some ways to those that remember, especially the third story, and that is Trilogy of Terror from 1975.
Do I make you nervous, Doctor?
Karen Black, a major star, creates a television first.
There's a golden chain wrapped around it to keep the spirit from making the doll come to life.
Face to face to face with the unbearable unknown. Trilogy of Terror.
So I've got a little clip of Richard Matheson talking about terror versus horror that I just wanted to drop in here.
You can get many points made through terror. I'm always said to be a top-notch horror writer, and I don't care for that. I would rather be a top-notch terror writer. The horror to me, as I've said many times, is visceral. It's guts coming out of, it's like that horrible-looking creature jumping out of John Hurt's stomach in Alien. Terror is the sort of thing that Jacques Tourneur used to work on. He did a picture called Curse of the Demon in England. And when I was just a teenager when I started seeing his pictures. And it was so subtle. You never... Then the producers, when they got the final cut, put in the beginning and the end a close-up of this clunky-looking monster. They don't get it. You can get away with a lot more, and it's a lot more frightening when you don't have it right in front of you.
And he's one of my favorite writers, so I think I give a little leeway in terms of quality in this film because of that. But I am very curious because when I pitched the idea of doing this movie on the show, you were, I don't want to say less than enthusiastic, but you were like ready to let me know that maybe your comments wouldn't be wholly positive. And so while I'm not by any means somebody who's like, this movie's a masterpiece, there are things I like about it, but I'm certainly open to the idea that there's a lot of problems with it. So
maybe it has a flaw or two.
Yes. I mean, before we get into that, let me just briefly say that it's an anthology of three stories, and it is a showcase for Karen Black, who I know we're both big fans of. And she plays in one story a community college professor, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, seems right.
Is that what her deal is in that one?
Well, yeah, she's a professor. I just didn't know if it was community college. I don't think they specifically say.
Oh, okay. I don't know why I heard somebody say that either in the commentary. Maybe it wasn't. And then she plays a dual role in the second one. I don't want to spoil that necessarily. And then she plays a woman who is famously attacked by a killer doll in the last segment.
So I was very used to character work and was, you know, had, I think, a certain amount of ethics in character work. That was my, what I thought was ethical to do as an actor was character work. So no, I wouldn't say I found it difficult to get used to the idea that there are lots of different characters because that was my life.
So it's basically four different roles, and I think she's... I'm curious to hear your take before we get into criticisms of the film itself. Like, do you think she does a decent job with what she's given?
She does an incredible job with what she's given.
Okay. Yeah, I think... I love her, and she is incredibly unique as an actor, and... really not like anybody else that I can think of. There just is only one Karen Black. And so on the level that I appreciate her, I like to see her get an opportunity to get a showcase like this. But that said, let's move into how your feelings about the film overall and the issues that you might have with it. Now, is it all the stories or any particular story, or let's hear it.
It's hard. I went in very open-minded.
Okay.
Especially keeping in mind that it can be very hard translating short stories, even with Richard Matheson, who seems like he was born to have his stories adapted. And it's still, you know, it takes a little bit, especially the second one, Millicent and Therese. That was the original story so short, he didn't even want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. He pawned off the adaptation to Bill Nolan for the first two stories and took the Zuni doll for himself in terms of teleplay.
He took the exciting one for himself, which I guess I respect that.
Sure.
So I think if I'm trying to think of myself as a young person in the 70s and I tune in, I'm really excited to watch something called Trilogy of Terror. And as I'm watching the first one, I think I would just start getting the inkling like, oh, okay, so there's not going to be like zombies or ghosts in this. It's going to be more of a thriller. Okay, I can be on board with that. So the first one, I thought it was interesting. I didn't know the main actor was her husband at the time.
That scene in Sanctuary where Faulkner has his character Popeye rape the girl. I prefer Fitzgerald. He only suggests violence.
Well, Faulkner was just telling it like it is. I guess some people enjoy violence, lead perverted lives. And speaking of perversion, there's a wonderful old vampire pic playing down at the Village Drive-In this Friday. It's all in French with English subtitles. It's a real classic. How about going to see it with me? For reasons of cultural expansion.
Well, I thank you, Chad, but... you know, teachers aren't allowed to date students. Or didn't you know that?
So who will find out? My lips are sealed. I won't tell.
You have your pick of all these lovely co-eds, Chad. Why would you want to date me?
Because I prefer maturity in a woman. All those others, they're just a bunch of kids.
Yeah. Mr. Skip / Robert Burton, I think.
I can't believe he didn't stick with Skip.
Yeah, it's interesting. She doesn't seem to... I mean, obviously they're not married anymore. She definitely doesn't seem to have fond things to say about him now. And he was apparently the main reason... or one of the main reasons she even did this at all was because he was acting or a budding actor, and she asked if he could be cast in the first story as a sort of caveat to her doing the movie. And they're good together, although it's a really creepy and strange scenario to play out with your husband.
Yeah. Though on one hand, I could understand because at first, on the surface, it seems like it's going to be a rape revenge story, straightforward. But there are some twists at the end. And I do feel like that's a very vulnerable role for a woman.
Yes.
Even with any kind of twist that may come in, you still have to be very vulnerable. And to have your husband playing that, I feel like would be pretty comforting.
Sure, absolutely.
So I do understand that. So the second one, on one hand, it's such a traditional setup. It opens up with Karen Black narrating a letter she's writing about her evil sister. And I really like that. I was like, oh, is this going to be like a little bit of an Edgar Allan Poe vibe? Like that could be fun. We're going to get a little bit more gothic. So she plays both sisters with, you know, wigs and makeup.
Why are you telling me this?
My sister is evil, Mr. Anmar. I think you should know that.
I must say I was very interested in, you know, that the spinster lady. I loved the ability. I didn't think I could play that for many years, that spinster lady whose mouth was drawn and tight and so forth and so on. The first shot was that spinster lady writing in her diary, but it meant so much to her, all this insanity that she was experiencing.
Demonology, pornography, Satanism, voodoo, witchcraft. These books aren't just relics, Mr. Anmar. She uses them to capture the souls of others. By her own admission, Satan guides her.
Her hatred of me is the only passion in her lonely, pathetic little existence.
Well, I like playing that little hot girl, too. Because I was worried about my thighs in those days, because, you know, when you're young, you have thighs. But you have to, like, hide with some kind of A-line skirt or something. But that was fun, sassing around. I didn't like my hair. Of course, it was false hair, and you could see through it. I hate that.
And quote unquote, there's a twist, but we all know it's going to happen. I'm not going to spoil it, but you know.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, okay, but there's going to be a twist. There's going to be something. And it's not. It just kind of ends. And by the end, I think that's why the Zuni doll segment is part of why it's so famous. I mean, we all love killer dolls.
Yes.
That's just, of all the horrors that we can experience some little piece of it in real life, killer dolls, as far as I know, that has not been documented, and I'm not sure it ever will be. So there's something kind of bonkers, but also really endearingly creepy about just a little killer doll running after you. But I think just after, you know, pretty like slow burn, quiet, like, oh, okay, stories. You're like, yeah, killer doll, get her, and it delivers. It really delivers. So I do understand that, but...
And she's epic in it. I mean, she is the only one...
Oh, she... Especially since, I guess, she was reluctant to take this on, like you said. She... That's the thing about Karen Black. When she signs on to a role, you get 1,000%.
Absolutely. Yeah, and even the phone conversation she's having with her mom in the beginning.
Mother, you should see what I'm getting for his birthday.
It's a genuine Zuni fetish doll. I found it in a curio shop on 3rd Avenue. Arthur teaches anthropology, that's why I got it for him. It's a Zuni hunting fetish. It's really interesting. There's supposed to be some Zuni hunter's spirit inside of it. And there's a golden chain wrapped around it to keep the spirit from making the doll come to life. Come to life. It says... Should the chain be removed, spirit and doll will become one living... Well, that's what it says. On the scroll. The scroll. It comes with a doll inside the box. You should see his face, Mom. Mom?
She makes a point to say in the commentary in the interviews that she talked with the filmmakers into... letting her sort of rewrite that conversation, and it's a great setup for, again, an overbearing mother scenario and she's not acting with anyone else on the phone, so that's just her, and then all her reactions are her, and apparently the Zuni doll is problematic and didn't work, much like the shark in Jaws, so she's having to do a lot of work with that. I mean, it's really impressive, you know, while being somewhat hysterical, because that's what it calls for. Anyway, I'm getting carried away, but I was just so impressed with her, regardless of the trappings, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off. So the Zuni doll story is problematic, is what where you're headed, I think?
Oh, I wasn't heading there, but I could talk about it. But okay. It kind of ties into one of the extras.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Well, we don't have to get into that just yet. But so how do you feel about that story overall? You said it delivers, so you think it's solid for what it's trying to do?
Yeah, and especially if you're on, I think, a small screen, that must have been wild. And I can imagine a lot of parents seeing the first two segments and being like, oh, okay, yeah, this isn't too bad. And they leave the room, and then, like, little Timmy's there watching this killer doll run around.
I'm sure that happened. I'm so sure, because a lot of these movies were like pretty big phenomenon in terms of like the number of households that were watching them. So I can't imagine there weren't some parents that were like, yeah, we're going to go get a pizza. You can just finish this. And then they come back and the kid's like hanging on the walls or something, you know, just absolutely terrified. And the sounds that the doll makes are just so great. Like, I have a thing about weird, creepy, animalistic sounds that don't sound like they're coming from an actual animal. They sound otherworldly and beastly and almost funny, but not quite funny. You know, that's what this thing does. And you're just like, ah, that's creepy.
Yeah, it fits, because it's such an otherworldly, crazy situation. It's like, yeah. It might sound a little cartoonish, but a nightmare cartoon.
Yeah. But so what other, your biggest issues are with the second story probably, or?
I guess that was the most disappointing one.
Sure.
I just don't have any cool memories with this movie, unfortunately. So just watching it with my jaded eyes, I pretty much just come away with a lot of admiration for Karen Black.
Sure.
But what's your history with this?
This one I had heard about, but never seen. I mean, not never seen, like, I had seen it at all, but, like, I didn't see it in the 70s, and I didn't see it in the 80s. I think I saw it when it came out on DVD in the late 90s from Anchor Bay, or was it 2000? I want to say it was the late 90s Anchor Bay release, and I had heard about it, I had read about it, and so it had been built up in that sense in my head, like, as this crazy movie, and I already loved Karen Black, so it was kind of a, not a holy grail, but something of a treasure that I was seeking out, and the Richard Matheson connection. I Am Legend is one of my favorite books of all time.
Same here.
And they still have yet to adapt it properly, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that they can, but
I thought the Vincent Price one wasn't bad.
Yeah, that's probably the best one for sure. But he's such an incredible writer, and so all these things together really built it up. And so I think I was a little disappointed when I finally saw it. But as you said, the Zuni doll sequence delivers pretty big time. At least it did for me when I first saw it. And so ultimately I was like, okay, I get it. I get why this movie has this appeal and why it has this lasting sort of cult status. Doing no small part to Karen Black herself.
She carries the whole thing.
I think, you know, I was a little disappointed, but ultimately I was like, okay, this is, I understand. But that's, you know, that's my basic history with it.
I just assumed you grew up with it too. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird. I didn't, like I said, we weren't hip enough to catch TV movies when they came out. For my parents, for whatever reason, just weren't aware of that stuff, you know? Like, we didn't watch the day after when it aired.
That probably would have scarred you too.
I'm sure it would have. I think the only thing we ever did that was like timely was we saw the first episode of Knight Rider. That might have been more me than them. Like, I had seen the commercials leading up to
it. Oh, yeah, a talking car.
NBC Monday Night at the Movies returns following these messages.
Knight Rider, the two-hour movie spectacular, crashes into your living room.
I don't believe this.
Don't miss Knight Rider the movie, Sunday at 8, 7, Central and Mountain.
Yeah, and I was telling one of my coworkers this the other day. I just remembered specifically David Hasselhoff saying something like, when he sees the inside of the car, he's like, this is like Darth Vader's bathroom. And I was like, oh man, Star Wars references? I'm so in.
Finally, a show for me.
Exactly, right? Because that's where I was when that show came out. I was fully in that mode. So anyway, that was the only time I think that we were on the quote-unquote cutting edge or ready at the moment of, you know, a television event. So I missed a lot of this stuff and had to come to it later. But anyway, let's talk about the extras here. There's several that are ported over from, I think, Dark Sky DVD special edition. But there is a new commentary track from Richard Harlan Smith, which I really liked. What did you think of the commentary track?
Yeah, I thought it was fine. It seemed like something happened with the audio during the second segment. It seemed like the audio of the film was at almost the same level as him. So that was actually hard to listen to.
Oh, yeah. I missed that. I don't know why I didn't. I thought I listened to the whole thing, and I must have.
Yeah, it's perfect during the first and third, but the second one, it just dropped.
Oh, crazy. Huh. I'll have to double check my copy and see if I had the same problem. I might have. But I thought he had a lot of interesting detail regarding the actors, the writers, the locations. He made some comparisons to Texas Chainsaw and Alien and Gremlins. In terms of his preparation and what he brought to it, it was almost on the level of, for me, and maybe I'm overhyping it, but it was almost on the level of like a Tim Lucas kind of wall-to-wall information kind of commentary. So I was really impressed with it from that standpoint. Although now, like I said, I have to go back and listen to that second part and see if I have a similar, I don't know if I just didn't notice it or what, but I liked his sort of, he seems like, Tim Lucas, I wouldn't say he's stiff, but he is a tiny bit in terms of when he does a commentary, which I don't mind, because when I'm listening to a Tim Lucas commentary, I'm kind of ready for that. But I felt like Harlan Smith was like a little more freewheeling and
sassy.
Yes, there you go. So anyway, let's talk about the other extras. You've got a Karen Black commentary with Bill Nolan.
I didn't want to do Trilogy and Terror at all. I didn't. I don't know, I wasn't attracted to doing it, and I had a manager at the time who thought that I should, and he came over to my real pretty house, and he plugged his chair down into the middle of the white living room and wouldn't budge until I said I would do this show till 4 in the morning. And finally I said, well, my husband wants to be an actor. Can he play the lead in the first story, Julie? And he said, okay. I'll arrange that. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Oh, and I wanted to do it for one more reason. The other reason I wanted to do Trilogy in Terror, it had nothing to do with the third story and the doll. It had to do with the second story, because I could wear these glasses, which I have very small eyes, and when I wore those glasses, they're magnifying glasses, they made my eyes really big. And so I didn't need any makeup on them. And therefore, I could play this elderly, spinster, close-throated, virgin person. You know, and I knew I would wait 20 years before I'd get another role like that. And I thought it was so interesting, to the challenge to try to play that kind of character.
You've got, there's a featurette on Matheson and one on Karen Black. Talk about those. What were your experiences like with that stuff?
There's also a new interview with the composer.
Ah, yes. I always miss those. God damn it.
There's that one was cute because it's a pretty basic interview, but then he starts doing the score by himself. He's like, and then it gets crazy, and it's like, bam, bam, bam. He's like doing all the sound effects. Just seeing this old man do all the sound effects is great. Like that made the whole thing for me. That's all I needed.
That's pretty great.
I'm guessing the audio commentary with Karen Black and William Nolan was from the earlier DVD you're talking about.
It was.
Yeah, it was interesting because Karen Black was very specific about her acting choices and how she felt during a scene. And William Nolan was like, uh-huh, uh-huh. So about the writing process, they were just both so tuned into their own crafts that it's kind of interesting. You can kind of see how sometimes relationships between writers and actors might not always go very smoothly. It's like,
yeah, it was a little bit almost, I don't want to say antagonistic.
No, it's just they were in completely different places.
Yeah, but it was funny because when he leaves the commentary, and it's a rare case where I haven't heard too many commentaries where one of the participants leaves during the commentary.
Oh, the best one. I'm sorry. It's the Goonies. And they're doing a video one. It's like a reunion of all the Goonies. And part of the way in, Sean Astin leaves because he has to go back filming Lord of the Rings.
I remember that now. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So other than that, I can't think of too many. But when Bill Nolan leaves, cause he's like, and again, so tuned into the craft of it, he's like, well, I had nothing to do with this last segment. I didn't write it. So I'm out. Yeah. Fuck y'all. Bye.
I would have, but okay.
But she's all very nice. Like she's all Bill, it was so nice to see you. And she seems very like they're friends, which it seemed a little stiff prior to that and a little awkward in places. And I couldn't really tell if she wanted to be in the room with him or not at points. But then at the end, it was very cordial and very like, oh, it was nice to see you, you know? Anyway, but her comments are really interesting because they are definitely, like you say, about acting choices. They're about aesthetic choices. They're about her ex-husband, you know? So it's interesting.
It is. And I guess it's also a ported over featurette of her being interviewed, and she's just so candid and so honest, and she's not mean, but she's really honest if she wasn't fully on board about something. And as big of a fan of her as I am, I didn't really know much about the star of her career or anything. So it's kind of like a Karen Black 101 coming from her directly.
So I went to see Dennis, and I thought Dennis was brilliant, and Peter. And they thought I was right for their movie. And then we went to do Easy Rider. Then we all went to this lunatic place. And everyone was a lunatic, except Tony Basil and myself. We were the only two non-lunatics. They were like doing whatever they were doing in the bus. And they were drinking, and they would miss the, they never could find the Mardi Gras parade. Never, they've never caught up with it because they were too out of their minds. Anyhow, I hid that I'd done that movie. I lied. I didn't tell anyone I'd done that. What the hell was I doing? It was horrible. Anyhow, then it got to be, I guess, one of the most important movies of that decade. And then, after this, that, and the other, they wanted to see me amongst many other girls for Five Easy Pieces. I just happened to be wearing the exact thing that Rayette would wear that day. And then, John Schlesinger was doing a movie, and I called him up, and he said he was going to go meet people, and I said, well, when you come back, you'll have Cassidy. He said, no, I don't think so. So I went to see him, and I put on a blonde wig, and it was a very, 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 very long audition. And so I did that movie.
Absolutely, and I agree. I also wasn't fully aware of her background, and, you know, I've known her through a lot of her early work, but I didn't really know some of the story behind it. And so, yeah, that was neat. I haven't seen a lot of interviews like that with her. So it was one of my favorite.
Yeah, like her being embarrassed about being an Easy Rider.
Yeah, that was funny. That was strange. I didn't expect to hear that.
I didn't want anyone to know I was in that movie, but I guess they liked it.
And then the Richard Matheson featurette, what did you think of that?
Well, what do you think of that? He's your favorite writer.
I don't know. I liked it. I thought I like when, like I said, that opening bit when he's talking about terror versus horror, I thought was intriguing. And I don't know. He kind of was what I thought he would be, but not in a bad way, in a way of like, he kind of doesn't give a shit because he understands he's a good writer, but he's not like totally brash and egotistical about it necessarily in a way that comes through as obnoxious. It's just sort of like, you know, just in the way that he talked about dealing with, you know, adaptation and, you know, producers and things like that, and getting annoyed with people and being grumpy with people. Like, it's clear that he's just like, you know, take me or leave me. Like, you know, I wrote the story, you can adapt it or not. I'm going to write more stories. I don't really care what you do. There's just something right about that attitude that I guess I think is interesting, from the point of view that I think he's one of the great writers. But what were your thoughts?
Yeah, is that about 10% Harlan Ellison when it comes to sass?
Yes, yes. Definitely toned down.
Yeah, I've been reading his stories for years, and I'm a huge fan of him. But I did get mad at him when he was talking about the last story about the Zuni fetish dolls.
What did he say?
He said, oh, I don't know where it's from. It's African, right? Yeah, I was looking up like witch doctors in an African book. The Zuni was... they're Native American. They're a tribe. I grew up in New Mexico, and that's a big area where they're from.
Interesting.
And fetish dolls are a big part of their culture. And if you go to New Mexico, you will pass stores. They'll say fetish dolls, really big on them. And I guess if you're a tourist, that can throw you off. You might get the wrong idea about what kind of store it is.
Yeah.
But it's a huge part of the culture. And just seeing him say, oh, I think it's African.
Yeah.
That blew my mind a little bit. He was so flippant about it. But fetish dolls, I grew up, they're normally animals, like smooth bears. I saw a lot of bears. They're just really pretty. You might see them a lot in just kind of southwestern decor. And you might not know that's a fetish doll. Though it needs to be blessed to be considered an actual fetish doll, and they're supposed to be very helpful, and you're supposed to store the real ones in turquoise. And if you're just buying one from a store, it's a carving. But
I didn't know this.
Yeah. So, and none of them look like the doll in this movie, and it's kind of a garish. Like, you can tell why he assumed it was African, because it's kind of a garish takeoff of like
a headhunter or something. I mean, I don't even know.
Like a tribesman, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But that part, it just, you know, even really brilliant people you're a fan of can really mess up.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. That is kind of off-putting, to say the least.
But yeah. that actually just the idea blew that my mind.
He either couldn't remember or he didn't bother to research, and or, like you say, just all of that runs together for him.
I feel like he, when he was doing research, he jumbled everything together, which that's a very writer thing to do. But then to talk about a specific tribe and say, I think it was African, when they're Native American.
Yeah, that's a pretty big
mistake. That's like, I don't know, maybe do a little refresher before your interview, dude.
Sure. But again, I think it all rolls into the, like, I don't give a shit kind of attitude, which is not in any way to forgive that mistake. It's just, it's clearly him. It's just the way he is, which is unfortunate, you know. Again, coming from a guy that I respect so much, as a, you know, in terms of the craft of writing and what he's able to do. I think Stephen King might have called him his favorite writer or one of the great writers ever. I know he's a big fan of him as a writer. Yeah, that's unfortunate. That is definitely unfortunate, you know, because it's probably one of the... is he? I don't think he's still alive.
No, he passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, so, you know, likely one of the last interviews he ever did. And to go out that way is like, well, that's too bad. But yeah, it was interesting to see him and hear him interviewed, and it makes me want to seek out more interviews with him, and maybe there's something that he did prior to that, that I just would like to hear him speak more on the craft based on the little that I heard in this featurette. So, but, so overall, you were more satisfied with this rewatch of Trilogy than you thought you'd be, or how did you feel about it?
Maybe a notch.
Notch more.
But it was pretty much, and I always go in with an open mind. I don't see the point in prejudging anything, or I always want to be entertained. I always want to be surprised. And I always keep budget in mind. I keep time period in mind. And, you know, I would have loved to see Karen Black do a version of Bad Ronald instead of...
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, that's something else.
Do you like of the Locust?
Do I like it?
Yeah.
I do. Her character is a bit difficult in that movie, but she plays it quite well. I must say, she really kills it. Like, she's just so sort of like irritating in this certain way, but in a way that feels, I don't know, real. It's a really great performance. I mean, I can't think of a movie that I've seen her in where I was like, yeah, she's just phoning it in. She really, like you said, she really commits. And because she's such an interesting personality outside, I mean, just listening to the commentary, you're like, this is a very, maybe a touch eccentric, but certainly unique spirit. And she definitely brings that to bear on her performances. And, you know, along with committing fully emotionally and physically in this movie, big time. I love her performance as much as I don't love that character personally.
Okay.
What do you think of that movie?
Oh, I hate it. But not because of her. I love the very, very short novel it's based on.
I should read that.
I was really excited to see the movie, and I thought it was brutal in the wrong way.
Interesting. I got to read the book.
It'll take you like half an hour to read, and it's really good.
The movie is by no means a favorite. Yeah, I mean, I like I like William Atherton, and he was not given too many roles like that. So that's intriguing. But beyond that, it's not a movie that I'm like, let's throw that on a Friday night. I probably haven't seen it in, you know, 15 years. It's been a long time.
Do you think anyway. Jennifer Coolidge is like the comedic version of Karen Black?
Wow, that's kinda, yeah. They have
where they're
they have
really
some stuff.
Brilliant, but because they play kind of like blousy characters, a lot of people underestimate them. But if you really sure. look at their choices, it's brilliant and perfect every single time. Something to think about.
When you put it like that. I can't really argue with any of those points, especially because Jennifer Coolidge is like operating on a level beyond what I think people are giving her credit for.
I agree.
And it is tricky because, like you say, it's a certain kind of character, so people make assumptions, but she's doing things. Because, you know, some of those movies you go back to and you're just like, or you see the outtakes or you hear her talk and you're just like, wait a minute, whoa. Whoa, there's a lot going on here. And maybe a lot of it is instinctual, which I think is the same with Karen Black and her, by the way. But it's coming from an incredibly organic place of, you know, artistic expression through acting, you know, not to get too grandiose about it. But there are just certain people that are conduits, you know, and able to do things, you know, physically, emotionally, psychologically, that are almost superhuman, and that's kind of how I feel about both of those actors personally.
Yes, training is important, and that can help so much. But if you do have that instinct,
yeah, there's just no.
I'm sorry, you can't learn that. And that's another thing I really loved about that interview with Karen Black is she really studied her craft. She really takes it seriously, and you could tell she just loved acting. I love it when you see an artist who could not do anything else. Not because they wouldn't be good yeah. at it, but because they were born to do this. And Karen Black was born to be an actress.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah, see, there are just certain people like that. There are born movie stars, and there are born like workman actors who will show up. Like, I don't like Kurt Russell is kind of like that for me.
Kevin J. O'Connor.
Kevin J. O'Connor. Yes, Kevin J. O'Connor.
I just love him, and I couldn't see him at a hardware store.
No, I wouldn't want to see that. No, no. I like Kevin J. O'Connor a lot. Ever since Deep Rising was the first time where I was just, when he, I remember one of my coworkers at the video store, we were watching either the trailer or we were talking about the movie. This is a friend of mine who really likes Deep Rising and Big Trouble in Little China, by the way, to bring it back to Kurt Russell. But just the bit where they're in the elevator and they hear a noise, and I think Treat Williams says to him, like, what was that? Or what is that? And there's music playing in the elevator, and Kevin J. O'Connor goes, the girl from Ipanema? And for whatever reason, that is a hilarious joke to me. And the first time I realized what that tune was.
Oh, wow, so that's a pivotal moment for you.
It was. Very formative. So from then on, I'm like, whenever I heard that song, I was like, oh, girl from Ipanema. Anyway, well, I'm glad we got to talk about these two, and there's definitely a you know, like Night Stalker and Night Strangler just came out, so we're getting a bit of a TV movie renaissance beyond Someone's Watching Me and these two.
Right.
So maybe we...
Network, strike while the iron is hot.
Right? Yeah, we need to get more stuff. But thank you, Stephanie, so much for indulging me with these TV movies. And you were far kinder to Trilogy of Terror than I thought you would be. I was ready for you to really...
Oh, I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No, it's not disappointing. I was just like bracing for...
I keep the angry language for texts. And then I try to be a little bit more fair on the actual podcast. And it's Karen Black. Very... She softens it. And
right?
I highly recommend that actresses, especially genre actresses, get Trilogy of Terror and study it.
Mm.
I think you could pick up a lot from it.
Good call. 100%. Listen to her commentary. Watch what she's doing. Watch that interview. It's really great. And it's short, too. It's not maybe like 16 minutes or something. Not long. But yeah, worth the price of admission for sure. A genuine masterclass in acting, wrapped in a sort of cheap genre packaging, but she really elevates. So anyway, thank you, Stephanie, for indulging and for coming back. I do appreciate you and the time you take with this stuff.
No, it's fun. I appreciate being asked back. I don't know that I'm contributing anything, but it's always an honor. It's always fun.
Well, yep. I'll be the first to say that you absolutely are. And I'm sure you'll hear some feedback about this episode in terms of what was contributed. So not in a bad way. Anyway, everybody have a lovely. Everyone have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week. And we will talk to you very soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.